Hey, folks, I'm Dr. Amy Perlman, your host for today's episode of Pearls and Perspectives. And I have a very special guest with us today. I have Dr. Chan. Dr. Chan, welcome to the crew.
Thank you so much, Dr. Perlman. It's great to be here with you.
Now, we actually have met before. We met at our American Urological Association meeting back in April of, 2025. And we met at the Urology Times, evening cocktail hour.
Yeah. How about that? And here we are on the Urology Times podcast, both Pearls and Perspectives.
I feel like this is the beginning of a joke. It's like when a sexual medicine specialist and a pediatric urologist walk into a bar, dot, dot,
dot. Dot, dot. Interesting things happen.
I want to give a brief introduction to our viewers today. So Dr. Chan is actually a pediatric urologist and has a big academic background, was at Indiana University and is currently at UNC, and recently had a little bit of a career shift and now is kind of in the industry space. And the focus of today's discussion is going to be on bladder cancer. And I was telling Dr. Chan, bladder cancer is a bit out of my wheelhouse, but it's all the rage these days. Everyone is talking about non-invasive, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. So I feel like even though I don't treat it, well, I need to know about it. And I think everyone listening does too.
I agree.
So yeah. Why don't we begin with how does a pediatric urologist get into the bladder cancer space?
That is a great question, Dr. Perlman. So yes, as you said, I am a pediatric urologist by training, and I spent quite a long time in academic urology, about 11 years, as a full-time practicing urologist. Always been really interested in research, and that's just always been my passion in addition to taking care of patients. And, I just did some soul searching, over the last couple of years and thought about, what my passions are and what I enjoy most about my job. And I realized that it's really, doing research. And I felt like I really wanted to have an opportunity to impact patients on a larger scale than what I could do, at the bedside or in the operating room, on a day-to-day basis. And so it got me thinking about some alternative career paths, if you will. And industry seemed like a great fit. I could really, use my research skills, put them to good use, and hopefully bring some innovative therapies to patients. And I could think of no better place than non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, as you said. It's such a hot area right now. And there's just been a ton of innovation, especially over the past 5 to 10 years.
Now, from what I recall, you hold a very important research position at UNC.
I did. Yeah. So I was vice chair of research for the department. And in that role, I was responsible for oversight of our clinical trials portfolio, a lot of which, of course, was urologic oncology focused, and several of which were bladder cancer studies. So I do have some familiarity with bladder cancer research, from my previous roles. And in addition, in my clinical practice, I had a small role in taking care of adult patients, on call and things like that. So I always kind of had a little toe in the water of adult urology, so to speak.
So I guess in pediatric urology, what are the relevant questions in that space?
As far as research is concerned?
Yeah, as far as research. Is it difficult to do research as a pediatric urologist?
It definitely is. I would say a lot of the research in pediatric urology, it's a little bit limited from the standpoint of randomized controlled trials, right? So we think of those as being the gold standard in clinical research. There just aren't a lot of randomized controlled trials in children, particularly in industry-sponsored trials. Most of the industry-sponsored work is done in the adult patient populations, and then we just use medications kind of off-label in children, typically, at least in pediatric urology, right? So it's a little different. There aren't, I would say the research infrastructure is a little bit more limited, and there isn't as much industry-sponsored work going on.
Yeah.
So it's a bit different. I think the focus is a little different as well. I think there's a lot of focus on, shared decision-making and development of patient-reported outcomes measures and things like that.
Yeah. So I think that's really important for young people who are kind of deciding, what field of urology I might want to go into is the opportunities for different types of research. And I think people need to identify that earlier on. It's interesting with randomized controlled trials. At the end of pretty much every retrospective study that's ever been published, the conclusion is we need more research and we need to do randomized controlled trials. And it sounds so obvious, but the reality of doing an RCT is very challenging.
Yes, especially in this day and age with, you know, what's going on at the NIH and how difficult it is to get grant funding, right? So I think looking to industry for support, I think, is key. And I think that's, I really believe in the collaborations between industry and academia. And that can, that's what's really, I think, going to push the field of urology forward. Mm-hmm.
So you bring up a very good point right there, because with your recent or somewhat recent career transition, how do you feel about what you're currently doing in today's political landscape?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel great about it because I feel that the patients are always number one in my mind, and I have a great opportunity to really impact bladder cancer patients and hopefully improve their quality of life and their clinical outcomes. I do also see a lot of potential for collaboration, like I said, between industry and academia. And I think that's a role that I hope to continue to play, you know, at enGene, at the company where I am now. We have a lot of different collaborators within academia, actually, to the point that it actually surprised me how many collaborations there are. I think it's a great way to kind of provide support for, you know, academic urologists who may be having trouble getting funding right now. Like, industry can help sponsor that. I know enGene and some of our other colleagues in this space are doing just that.
Oh, I love talking about surprising facets of healthcare. Mm-hmm. So why don't we delve into that a little bit? Coming from your academic background, what were some of the things that you assumed about industry that you found to either be surprisingly true or surprisingly false?
Oh, interesting. So let's see. I guess I didn't really, like, well, one thing I will say, I didn't really appreciate just how much scientific rigor goes into an industry-sponsored trial. I think, you know, among academic urologists, you know, industry maybe has a certain sort of reputation. You know, people may think, well, it's biased, it's industry-sponsored. The reality is you absolutely have to conduct a trial with the utmost scientific rigor to get it past the FDA, right? And the other thing I did not realize is just how closely FDA looks at your submission. Like, when you're putting in, well, in our case, it's going to be a biologic license application or BLA. That's just like what gene therapy does, right? So when you put your BLA submission in, the FDA scrutinizes every little piece of data, and they actually get the raw data. It's not like just some summary that you give them, right? So they don't just sort of take your word for it. So, like, the level of detail and scrutiny in every application is just really surprising, I think, to me. The other piece I found really surprising, like, I kind of knew that clinical trials were complicated. Like, you kind of know that, right? As a urologist, like, yeah, this is like kind of a complicated thing. I did not fully appreciate the complexity and the logistics involved, like, in truly running like a global clinical trial like we're doing with Legend, and having like over 85 sites in multiple different continents, and people working together in multiple different time zones and multiple different cross-functional teams. Like, I had no concept of how complicated it was. And that's been part of the joy, actually, is like just learning a whole new space, you know? So that's one thing I really love about the job.
Yes.
It's just the complexity of it.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because the one industry-sponsored clinical trial that I was involved with when I was at the University of Iowa, I agree, it is so complex. You know, we had a research coordinator that would help enroll patients, but when she wasn't available and I was enrolling patients, I had to tell my team, I was like, I'm going to be in this room for the next 3 hours.
No kidding.
Let's make sure you're, you know, crossing all the T's and dotting hit I's, and you get all the history. And like in other trials, you kind of just retrospectively look at the charts and you hope you get some good information.
Yeah.
But these prospective trials, wow, all the details matter. It is challenging.
Yeah, they really do. The devil's in the details, without a doubt. When those informed consent pages are like 90 pages documents or something, right? The other thing I wanted to add to it that was, I think it was really, maybe I guess you could say it's a surprise, but I didn't realize how much, I know this may sound a little cheesy, but like I didn't realize how much teamwork mattered in industry. Like, it definitely matters in the operating room. And I did not realize how many transferable skills I would have in that realm and how useful that would be. Like, all my work as a surgeon, all my work leading teams, right? Mentoring residents, talking to nurses, like leading the team in the OR. Like, you can think of a million ways at which people are leaders, right? In academic urology. That is incredibly valuable in industry, because
one thing that you realize, and it's, to be honest, it's quite humbling when you come into industry as like a newbie, is that you realize how much you don't know about drug development. Like you kind of come from academia, right? You're like, oh, I'm the expert. I know what I'm doing. And all of a sudden it's like, I don't know what I'm doing, right? From the standpoint of like drug development A to Z, right? And so you come in and I think having the ability to be an absolute team player and collaborate with people in other functional roles is critical, and it will be highly valued, right, for people who are considering that transition.
And you are interacting with very different people than what you're used to, right? Because within you're used to interacting with people within the pediatric urology space. So
right.
Think about the different personalities between maybe the world of pediatric urology and now urologic oncology.
Oh, yeah. It's a little different. I will say it's the gender ratio is a little different. That's sort of the first sort of obvious thing, right, that you notice. You know, obviously urology as a whole, as we know, 11% women. So it's a fairly male dominated field. I think that's well established. Pediatric urology, not as much. I think it's a little more balanced, you know, in terms of gender ratios. I believe there are about 4% of practicing urologic oncologists are women. So as you can see, it's a bit different. I think women are even less represented in that subspecialty than urology as a whole, right? But it's changing, right? I do see a lot of women up and comers, which is cool. But as far as, there are definitely some interesting personalities, but there are, you know, everywhere. I think, again, my experience in academia has well equipped me to deal with that, you know, understanding, you know, people and just how to relate to them, right? So, yeah, it's been a trip. I think one challenge, I think, for me, has been my professional network has been, you know, historically very pediatric urology centric, as you would imagine, right? For pediatric urologists, obviously, right? I spent years developing this network, you know, within the subspecialty, which extended to some extent to the broader field of urology, but not a ton. So then like leaping over into bladder cancer drug development, like I'm really having to make a concerted effort to like get to know the key players in the field, right? Because I think that's a really important part of this job. You know, I think our CEO says it well. He's like, we want to be the company for urologists. Like, we want to serve the needs of people who are practicing. And so part of that is like building relationships and like really make an effort to get to know the people who will be ultimately delivering the therapy.
Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of people within the field are wondering, how do I become a key opinion leader? So when you're looking for who are the key people that you need to network with and reach out to, like, how do you know who to reach out to?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I rely on my lovely medical affairs colleagues. So in all seriousness, and those are the folks who are really, that's part of their big job in all seriousness is to, you know, engage with those key opinion leaders and help identifying them. I think there's, you know, some obvious things. I think one thing I look at, again, I'm the new kid on the block, you know, trying to find my way, but I look at the big organizations, right? Like who's a Society of Urologic Oncology, who's serving on the board, who's on International Bladder Cancer Group Retreat, which I had the pleasure of attending last weekend, led by Ashish Kamat. That was a delightful group. That's, you know, kind of an invite-only group of, those are seriously like the key opinion leaders, no doubt. There's other groups, International Bladder Cancer Network, of course, folks at the AUA. I mean, there's definitely, I kind of look to those organizations. Another one, a key organization I would say is BCAN, so Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network. It's the big, you know, patient engagement network. They also do a lot of work around advocacy and research as well. So there's folks that are on that board as well. And then you look at kind of people as far as like who's kind of out there. You know, talking to as representatives for other companies, right? Like who's doing some consulting work, who's on the podium at AUA, like presenting for XYZ company. Those are definitely people to watch, in my opinion.
And then are you using digital platforms to help, you know, inform those decisions as well? Like, are you looking on LinkedIn to see who's posting on different topics?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, we as a company, we have a LinkedIn page. We're quite active on LinkedIn. I will say it's been my observation that academic urologists aren't necessarily always on LinkedIn and certainly maybe not community urologists. That's another, I should also say, importantly, another group we want to reach is the community urologists, right? But I think, you know, Twitter, I think people are still active on that, maybe Blue Sky. That's a good point. But yeah, I haven't seen as many folks active on LinkedIn. I'm not sure, you know, why that is. But I do think that's actually, speaking of industry transitions, when you transition to industry, you definitely need to be active on LinkedIn. That's one thing I've kind of noticed, speaking of those differences. Like,
everybody in industry is on LinkedIn and quite active. Not so much in academic urology, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really important point is for anyone watching, especially if you're early on in your career, you're interested in maybe a career transition, get on LinkedIn. Find out a lot about, you know, the potential opportunities. You see what different companies are up to. It's interesting. I'm involved with a lot of different advisory roles and consulting opportunities. And it's because people see that I'm posting a lot on LinkedIn. And I think they're hoping they want to get their message out. And so if they find someone who's already kind of talking about the stuff that their company is involved with, I think that's how I've gotten some opportunities. But I think that's also a call to action for people who are interested in being key opinion leaders. You don't just become one, right? You have to develop your reputation, which can take years to develop.
Yeah.
But also, you know, you got to be involved in societies and on boards and really show your involvement because you're telling us right now, that's how you decide in large part, you know, who you're going to reach out to as KOLs.
Yeah, for sure. It's like people who are kind of visible out there, you know, involved in, you know, company presentations, like I said, academic societies, that those are really important. Those all increase your visibility for sure. Mm-hmm.
So one more question before we delve into bladder cancer, and that is, do you have to choose? Is it industry or is it clinical medicine?
I would say no. So I think there are many ways to go about a career. I've heard this, I don't know if you've heard this term, is this idea of like a portfolio career, which you sort of pick and choose, you know, kind of what you want to do. You don't have to do one thing all the time. You can mix it up a little bit. I would say if people are interested in industry, I would definitely recommend practicing for a while as a urologist. It's not something where it's easy to go into it like right after residency or fellowship, as tempting as it may be for some folks. I would say absolute minimum about 5 years, maybe even like 10 to 12. I was told the sweet spot is about 10 to 12 years of practice before making the transition. I was right about in that sort of range at 11 years. But I think, you know, my case, like I said, I do still practice very part-time, just 2 days a month. I think it's possible to keep practicing, but you really have to think carefully about how much you identify as a surgeon and whether you want to be in the operating room, like on a regular basis. And if you are okay with walking away from the OR most of the time and you really want to focus on, you know, research and other things, then industry could be a good fit. But if you're not quite ready to walk away from the OR, I don't think industry is may not be the right time for you to make that transition. I will say one question I've gotten actually from a urologist recently. This person asked me, well, could I do like 50-50? Like, could I just do, you know, 50% practice, 50% industry? And I said, I don't think so. I think most industry jobs are going to want you there like 85 to 90% of the time. Or maybe they wouldn't want you practicing at all. I think the 50-50 would be tough.
Yeah. You know, in my practice, and I have a private practice in Miami, Florida, so much of my time, at least, you know, during business hours, is on clinical medicine. So my involvement with industry and these advisory boards, sometimes I'll schedule meetings during the day or in the evening. So I can do as much or as little of that as I want. And a lot of those opportunities, I mean, as a consultant, you get paid hourly. So it's another right to bring in some income. You know, it's so funny. In academics, we do so much for nothing.
Yeah.
Just like excited for the opportunity. But like outside of academics, I mean, we've worked so hard to develop our skills and our expertise. So when someone says, hey, I would love to sit down with you for an hour to pick your brain. Hey, we're a consultant.
Yeah.
It's an editorial for expertise.
Yeah. Yeah. And that actually brings up a great point, Dr. Pearl, before we move on to the next topic. Just want to mention, consulting is a great way to like dip your toe in the water. If you're thinking about a transition or maybe thinking about it like long-term down the road, if you can get like, you know, be a consultant for a company or be a speaker or be a site PI for an industry-sponsored trial, you could learn a lot of valuable information from that perspective as the site PI. So there are a lot of great ways to get involved without like fully taking the plunge like I did.
I love it. So I've been super excited about this conversation so far. So let's see if I can keep up the enthusiasm for bladder cancer.
You can do it, Dr. Furlman. I will help you out.
Okay. So as we were alluding to before, everyone's talking about non-muscle invasive bladder cancer these days. So for people who might be newer in this space or may not have the full idea of the landscape, give me like a quick overview. What's the current landscape of treatment options when it comes to non-muscle invasive bladder cancer?
Yeah. Well, first I'll start off by giving my theory on why everybody's talking about it. Like, why is this area so hot?
It's all thanks to the FDA, I think, because the FDA recognized what we like to call an industry as a significant unmet need, which there is. So bladder cancer patients have a significant unmet need because there just aren't a lot of great options other than BCG, right? So as we know, BCG is the standard of care, right, for high risk high-risk patients, right, with non-muscle-invasive bladder cancer. Problem is, when they fail BCG, standard of care historically, of course, has been radical cystectomy. We all know all the issues, the morbidity, mortality associated with that, right? So the FDA recognized this back in 2018. They said, you know, these patients really need some more options other than cystectomy. So other than BCG, right? So they released what they call draft guidance, which is basically a fancy way of saying they issued a document, they put it online, and they basically sent a message out to all the drug companies and said, you know what? You can do a single arm open label study and get approval for your medication based on that trial design. So that was like, whoa, that was a big change, because in the past, companies had to do, you know, the sort of the classic randomized controlled trial, hundreds of patients, really long, expensive studies. This was a faster path to drug development. And so a bunch of companies went, whoa, this is great. And so it spurred a lot of innovation in the space. And that's what we're seeing now, is that several newly approved therapies are on the market. There's a couple more, you know, kind of in trials right now, including us at InGene. And so it's really exciting for patients, because hopefully this will provide patients with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer with a lot more options besides just BCG or cystectomy.
So I feel like that is a good segue into, it's a little bit polarizing, right, with like the COVID vaccines and everything, for fast tracking of medications. So how do you think in this topic, when it comes to bladder cancer, what are the pluses and minuses of this fast track?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think on the plus side, as you said, you know, it's faster. So therapies can get to market faster than you would have historically with, like, you know, a randomized controlled trial. The other, I think, huge plus, which I, you know, kind of mentioned, is that the fact that it's has spurred a lot of innovation. And so there's a lot of companies working on this because it is a little bit of an easier path. I think with that being said, I mean, there's still scientifically, it must be rigorous. And the FDA is certainly, I can tell you, reviewing these applications with a fine tooth comb, you know, to make sure that everything's done correctly. I think I will acknowledge there are some challenges with the study design, as I think anybody who's done a course in clinical research could tell you. You know, randomized controlled trials are the gold standard for a reason. It allows you to deal with, for example, heterogeneity in your cohort. You know, you could randomly assign patients to like group A or group B so that, you know, you can limit the issues with confounding, right? So you can see like whatever happens to them, is it because of the drug, right? Not because of some difference in baseline characteristics. So that is a powerful tool, you know, having the RCT. So I think certainly there are downsides to that study design. You can't have heterogeneous cohorts. But I think what the FDA has done to kind of address that and sort of make it, you know, the outcome as uniform as possible, they said the outcome should be complete response rate. And that's what everybody has done. And so, you know, definitely acknowledging that cross-trial comparisons are still challenging. But still, if you look at what all the companies have done, it's pretty consistent across the board. They're looking at complete response rates as well as durability. And I think the durability for a lot of urologists is really the key. That's what people care about, is like, how long do these therapies last? How long can a patient, you know, stay in complete response?
Mm-hmm. To touch on some of the challenges specifically within the bladder cancer space, I mean, when I think about all the different topics that we can do research on, you know, I must admit, it seems like bladder cancer might be one of the more challenging.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is very challenging. I think for a number of reasons, I think there is a lot of tumor heterogeneity. The tumor biology is different from patient to patient. There's all sorts of sources of heterogeneity, like whether somebody has carcinoma in situ by itself, or they have carcinoma in situ with a papillary tumor, whether they have T1 disease, which we know is associated with the worst prognosis, right, in terms of recurrence and progression, whether they have variant histology, there's like a million things, right? So that's the sort of the heterogeneity in the tumors is challenging. And then there's the issues with like the BCG shortage, right? So there's been this like kind of chronic global shortage, which I'm sure your listeners are well aware of, right? It's been going on for a while,
which has resulted in what I would call some creative solutions with BCG administration, meaning patients may have gotten like reduced doses, or maybe they didn't quite get the full course of induction, or maybe they didn't quite get all the maintenance. So that becomes challenging for drug development in this space because the FDA's guidance that I mentioned, this amazing guidance from 2018, the tricky part with that caveat is that it's really for BCG unresponsive patients with CIS, right? So it's that you have to become BCG unresponsive in order to fall under this guidance. But to do that, you need to actually get enough BCG, right? So it's tricky to find the patients, right? So the recruiting for these trials can be quite challenging, right? If patients are just like BCG exposed, they didn't quite get enough BCG, right, to qualify for study entry.
Yeah, I always feel like whenever I'm thinking about or brainstorming about a study, like in my mind, I think it'll be so easy to recruit patients for this study.
Right.
Actually outline all the inclusion and exclusion criteria.
Yeah.
It is extremely challenging to recruit the trials.
Yeah, I think it is really challenging. I mean, the good news for us is that for all the, you know, the bladder cancer patients out there is that we hope that in real world clinical practice, like patients who are BCG exposed will probably be eligible for these therapies, even if they would not have been eligible for the trial, right? If they like got some amount of BCG, hopefully payers will approve them, right? That's sort of what it's hinging on, is what will the payers approve. But fingers crossed for all the patients out there, you know, who haven't quite gotten the quote full amount of BCG, that they will still be eligible for these therapies.
Okay, well, so let's dive into enGene's investigational agent. And I am not going to even pretend to try to pronounce the name of it. Dr. Tran, I'm going to leave that up to you.
Okay, well, it is detalimogene. So one way to remember that is it's a gene therapy and there's gene at the end. So that's kind of a fun little trick, detalimogene.
We're really like, how do companies come up with these names?
You know, that's a whole thing. We could do a separate podcast on that, Dr. Perlman. Funny story, I actually was one of the first things I got involved in was like our naming workshop. There's like literally people that is their job is to come up with the drug names. Like we actually have like engaged a consultant for that. Oh, amazing. And it's actually, believe it or not, like everything else in clinical trials, very complicated because you want to make sure as far as the brand naming is concerned. So we'll have a new brand named, you know, hopefully once we get approved, that kind of thing. We'll have a new brand name that we haven't created yet. But you have to make sure that it doesn't sound too much like the other drugs and that, you know, the FDA will approve it. And there's like a million considerations. But anyway, I'm not sure exactly where detalimogene came about, how that came about, because that preceded my time at the company. But that's what it is for now before we come up with the brand name.
So tell us more about this agent.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing I think is really exciting about it, as I think you kind of alluded to this earlier in the podcast, it's a non-viral gene therapy. So just to back up for a minute, I kind of like to give an overview of like what is viral versus non-viral gene therapy, because I imagine some of your listeners may not be particularly familiar with that. Full confession, I was not familiar with that until the day that I interviewed for the company for the job. So not exactly your typical urology topic, right? So basically, you know, gene therapy is very exciting. I think when a lot of people hear the word gene therapy, they're probably thinking of the more traditional ones, which are typically viral vectors. So the vector is basically just like what is carrying the genes, right? And so in the traditional ones, the most common viral vector is an adenovirus. And there actually are a couple either coming to the market or on the market already that are adenoviral vectors, right? So those have some challenges. They have some limitations in terms of the DNA payload. So how much DNA can they carry? They can be highly immunogenic, which means they can kind of set off an adverse immune response. Like you rev up the immune system a little too much. And they can be pretty challenging to manufacture at scale. And so that's certainly a concern when you're like launching a new product and you want to get it into the hands of urologists. You want to make sure you can manufacture it. So the other thing I think to note about gene therapy is that there's some that are sort of integrating into the patient's genome and some that are non-integrating. Thankfully, this one is non-integrating, unlike some of the other drugs on the market out there, right? They've probably got a lot of press recently. So the advantages of non-viral, as you can imagine, so it's basically addresses some of the issues I just mentioned with viral therapies. You can have a much larger DNA payload. They're not as immunogenic. You can redose them fairly frequently. And then they're much easier to make, actually. And much easier, I should also add, much easier in terms of like storage and handling. And that makes, to me as a urologist, that makes a really big difference. So for dental imaging, the beauty about it is that it can be stored in just a regular freezer. It comes as a powder. So it's a lyophilized powder, which basically means you take it out of the freezer, let it sit on the counter, and basically reconstitute it with sterile water and then instill it into the bladder, kind of like BCG. But it doesn't have the like BSL-2 safety precautions like BCG does. You don't have to bleach your urine afterwards. You don't have to have contact precautions with loved ones like you need to do with viral therapies. So I think to me, that's a really big advance. It's very much so for patients and then also for urologists. It just makes it a lot easier to actually administer it in the clinic. And it reduces some of the issues with, you know, like I said, with some of the viral therapies.
Yeah, that's a big one because there are a lot of therapies out there and interventions that a lot of us as healthcare providers would love to be able to offer to our patients.
Yeah.
But if we don't have the infrastructure in place, it doesn't matter.
Exactly. Yeah. So in this case, you don't really need any additional infrastructure. Most people should have a regular freezer in their clinic. And obviously, they're very adept at giving BCG, so they can obviously can catheterize patients and put medications in the bladder and everything. So, you know, I think that's a big advance. Another thing I should also add in terms of our mechanism of action. So I would be remiss if I didn't talk about that. So that's pretty cool because it activates both innate and adaptive immunity. So I mentioned the DNA payloads. It actually codes for 3 genes. There's 2 double-stranded RNA agonists that stimulate the RIG-I pathway, which basically stimulates the innate immune system. And then it also stimulates or secretes the IL-12 protein. And that's a potent anti-tumor cytokine. So that stimulates adaptive immunity. So it's kind of like the 1-2 punch, kind of recruiting the immune system to the bladder where the tumors are located to really rev it up and then attack the tumor.
So talk to me about where your company currently is at in terms of clinical trials and the approval process.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've actually got, so I kind of alluded to earlier in the podcast, I was talking about the LEGEND trial. So the LEGEND trials are ongoing global clinical trial that I kind of briefly talked about before. It's got multiple cohorts, 4 cohorts total, actively enrolling across the globe, with our targeted accrual of about 300 patients across all the cohorts. I mentioned that one in particular, of course, is a registrational cohort. That's cohort 1. And so that's BCG unresponsive NMIBC with carcinoma in situ. And that's the one that we're going to be submitting to the FDA. And we're targeting a submission of mid-2026. So that is well underway. And at this point, you know, just a matter of kind of wait and see. You know, we want to wait and see how the data looks, how the data matures. As I mentioned before, I think what everybody's really looking at with all of these drugs is, you know, not only complete response rate, but durability. And so, you know, we'll have to see how that turns out. But we're very excited. I think it certainly has had really promising preliminary data as far as safety and efficacy. I'm also happy to share we're going to be releasing some more data by the end of this year. So stay tuned. But before December 31st, we should have another data update. I know a lot of people are eagerly anticipating that, particularly for cohort 1.
You mentioned this study is involving 85 sites around the world. So let's say someone might be interested in becoming a site for enrollment. What does that process look like? Is that you or someone from your company reaching out to these KOLs, or might some of these KOLs reach out to your company with interest?
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely we welcome anybody who wants to reach out to us. I'm happy to engage in a conversation. There's always, you know, as far as the current study, we are enrolling patients. As far as adding sites right now, you know, we are still onboarding some sites. I will say we have mostly onboarded most of the sites already. However, with that being said, there are always opportunities for future collaborations. You know, there will be, of course, inevitably other clinical trials kind of coming down the pipeline. So there certainly could be opportunities for sites to be activated at a later date. So if anybody's even remotely interested, definitely encourage them to reach out for sure. I'm happy to discuss further.
You know, when I was back in residency, and it wasn't that long ago, I mean, I was training at University of Pennsylvania from 2012 until 2017, and bladder cancer seemed so much simpler back then.
Yeah.
It wasn't even that long ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess my question for you is, how easy or difficult, or is it somewhere in the middle? What's the protocol when someone becomes a candidate for using this medication?
Yeah, as far as
like administration, so far, like how administration has to come into the office. What's like the burden on the clinic and the patient?
Yeah, great question. So I like to say it's better than BCG. That's kind of our tagline. We're better than BCG in a lot of
that ways. Sounds like a great t-shirt.
I know, but yeah, it was my thing, though. I mean, this is not the opinion of the company. This is Kate's opinion. I think it's better. So in all seriousness, though, it's given a total of 4 times over a 12-week period. And so it's weeks 1, 2, 5, and 6. And of course, it's a little different than BCG. Obviously, that's an induction course of weekly for 6 weeks, right? So patient gets a little bit of a break in there. It is given over 4 cycles total. So that's kind of going up to 48 weeks. So roughly about a year. Patients who are in complete response at that point can enter a maintenance phase. And so it kind of dials down a little bit to 2 doses per 12-week cycle. So when they come into clinic, fairly straightforward. They would come in, have the bladder, the nurse or NA, whomever, would drain the bladder, of course, to catheterize them, and then put the study drug in. It's 50 milliliters in a solution. Like I said, it's dissolved in sterile water. Targeted retention time is about 1 hour. At that point, they would void and then go home. So that's kind of the protocol right now as far as the clinical trial is concerned. Fairly straightforward. Not a lot of worries, like I said, in terms of storage handling or any concerns with, contact precautions or anything like that.
Now, with some of these intravesical agents, sometimes there are concerns with worsening irritative voiding symptoms. Do you see that with your agent?
That's a great question. So the preliminary safety data and tolerability data is very encouraging. We've had completely grade 1 and 2 adverse events reported so far that were treatment related. That was from our data cut that we did last September. We will have more information on safety and tolerability, like I said, as part of our data release by the end of this year. But so far, preliminary safety data looks very, very encouraging. It seems to be, well tolerated and safe. So I think that's a good thing. I will say this patient population, and you were kind of talking about, the challenges of this patient population, which are many. One I will add to that list of challenges with this patient population is just the bladders are pretty beat up. These patients by definition are BCG unresponsive. By definition, they've had a ton of BCG already. And so they tend to, as you said, they come in the door already with these irritative voiding symptoms. So one thing that, we definitely have, talked to some PIs about and help them troubleshoot, how can we make this better for patients? Certainly if they want to give anticholinergics, beforehand, they're more than welcome to. I know there are some investigators out there who are looking at this, some ways to do that. I think Mark Tyson at Mayo Clinic, and I know the Mayo group down in Florida as well. They had a poster actually at AUA on rectal Valium. They did a retrospective case series on rectal Valium for their patients who were getting intravesical therapy, and it really seemed to make a difference as far as their ability to tolerate the medication and really maintain it for the desired dwell time. So I think that's a really important area of future research for sure.
And you had mentioned that, large population of people that you want to engage with are going to be community urologists. So if this agent is approved, what are the implications on community urologists?
Yeah, for sure. So we are very much, in my opinion, wanting to make this very attractive for community urologists. I certainly think it will be. We actually just last week had our community urology steering committee. So really excited to be engaging some leaders in the field of community urology. I think as far as hopefully it's a game changer, right? I mean, I think is, one thing they're looking at, I think, to be fair, academics are looking at this as well, but very much so in community practice, it's all about, what's the bottom line? You have to run it like a business and you have to think about, your overhead, your revenue, how are you getting these medications in the door? What is the impact on your practice? How does this impact your practice efficiency? So I'm hoping this is a home run, right? Because this would be something where they don't need to worry about a lot of extra infrastructure or tying up the staff for a long period of time, right? So I'll be curious to see, kind of the response we get, but we're continuing to network certainly amongst the community urologists about this.
So let me ask you this. If you were to sit down with a community urologist and say, write me a wish list of what you would want a bladder cancer medication to look like what, I feel like it's, that movie, What Do Women Want? What does a community urologist want when it comes to the treatment of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer? And you kind of mentioned the bottom line part. Are there other?
Right. That's part of it. Yeah. The other piece I would say, that we heard from our steering committee, actually, which is really interesting, is
you know, give me some help with sequencing these treatments. Like, there are going to be, there's like, as I said, there's been sort of an explosion already, right, of therapies for NMIBC. Just wait a couple years. There's probably going to be, who knows, maybe 8 or 9 options on the table. If you include Jim Doci, radical cystectomy, clinical trials, the currently approved agents, and the several that are going to be approved, right, in the next like 6 to 18 months, it's getting a little out of control. So they're like, help us figure out how to sequence, right? I think that is certainly high on the wish list. But other things I think are important as well are, you know, limiting the dwell time, limiting the patient burden, like the fewer doses per cycle, the better, if, you know, as long as they can maintain efficacy. I will say the other thing that was really interesting that we learned from our steering committee was they really care about efficacy, like very much so. And I think that's true among academic urologists as well. I think most, in general, what I've seen is most people would rank efficacy number one as far as priorities. I think, and that wrapped into that, of course, is durability. So that was one thing, you know, I found a little bit surprising. So I think efficacious, you know, minimizing the patient burden, minimizing the burden to the practice, you know, being favorable in terms of the revenue that it generates for the practice, and not requiring any like extra infrastructure or equipment or staff or things like that. I think, and then it's something that they can, you know, get approved pretty easily, right? Sort of straightforward as far as that prior off conversation goes.
Yeah. So I feel like the one other really hot topic in healthcare other than, you know, bladder cancer is artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. Does Engine use artificial intelligence with any of these technologies? Or does it help inform any of the decision-making as far as, you know, you're aware?
Yeah, that's a great question. Not specifically. I would say, but as far as artificial intelligence and bladder cancer, I have seen some really exciting work being done by a couple of other companies. I don't know, your listeners may be familiar with Valor Labs. That also kind of made a splash at AUA. That is an AI-based tool for looking at pathology slides, like H&E stains, extracting data from them, and then figuring out who, like the prognostication for patients with bladder cancer, like who is going to progress, who is going to recur. And then also the other thing really cool they're doing is predicting response to BCG. So that I think is kind of like wave of the future, like some of these AI tools, right, to help predict like recurrence, progression, and response to these different therapies. Like that may help solve the community urologist dilemma about how do I sequence therapies? What is my patient going to respond to, right? Well, in the future, maybe we'll have AI tools to help us with figure that out.
I think so many of us go into urology because we're early innovators and adopters of new technology, but yeah, that comes a lot of accountability and sometimes it becomes overwhelming.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge, right? And using technologies like artificial intelligence to help kind of augment our knowledge and help with decision-making, I think is going to be key, as you mentioned.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely. I think that'll be great. I think that, as I said, the urologists are really asking for, you know, something to help. And maybe that's biomarkers, maybe that's something else. But I think the other piece, as you said, you know, what you said, overwhelming, it made me think of like, what are some ways to sort of address that overwhelm? And other thing that may happen as far as like, where's this field going, right? With this explosion of therapies, we may start to see more and more like specialized centers of care. Like there's a bladder cancer center of excellence, and it's not just in academia. Like maybe we'll even see that in the community. And I think we're starting to see that already with like some of the more broad-based general urologists were like, this is too much to keep track of. I'm going to send this to my partner who like just focuses on bladder cancer. So we may start to see more and more of that like sub-specialization.
Before we wrap up, I'm so glad you brought up that point because so many people that are early on in their careers and they're deciding after fellowship, should I go into academics? Should I go into private practice? You know, I initially went into academics because I'm a very curious person and I wanted to do research. And now that I have a very private practice, I'm still involved in a lot of those initiatives that I was involved with in academics. And so my vision of the difference between academics and private practice has completely shifted.
Yeah.
Okay? And I've come to this realization that if you want to be curious and do research and innovate the field, you can do that in any type of practice. What would your message be to, let's say, community providers or people who are deciding where should I go when it comes to being involved in really high-level research like you're involved in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you should definitely not discount the opportunities as a community urologist. That's speaking of, I know you asked me at the beginning of the podcast, what surprised me about industry It surprised me how many academically minded community urologists there are who are involved in really high level, impactful, industry sponsored or otherwise research. Like there are actually some of these LUGPAs, for example, these, you know, large urology group private practices that they actually have like their own research coordinators and they have their own like clinical trial lead. Like there are actual clinical trialists who are urology trained and are like working at these LUGPAs and like doing amazing things, like bringing in tons of industry sponsored trials and really providing like the state of the art care for their patients. Like that's been a real eye opening for me. So my message to be would be don't discount the academic opportunities in private practice. They're absolutely there. Certainly academics is one way to go. I think it's not the only answer. And I think academics is especially challenging these days because there's still that, you know, the struggle with NIH grant funding is really very much front and center right now. So I would just keep your options open and maybe consider both.
So if I had a megaphone, which I don't, but maybe the podcast is going to go viral. So who knows? You know, So I'm going to give you two megaphones. And the first megaphone is if you had a message that you wanted to tell our urology colleagues when it comes to, you know, bladder cancer or anything else, what would your message be?
Yeah, my message would be, you know, stay tuned for some really exciting developments coming up in the next 6 to 12 months. I think, you know, now this has never been a better time for patients and urologists and bladder cancer care. I think it's so exciting and I cannot wait to see what the future holds.
So I'm going to give you one more megaphone. I want you to talk to patients. Patients who might be experiencing or suffering from bladder cancer. What's your message to them?
Yeah, I think as far as the patients are concerned, my message is don't give up hope. You do have options now. If somebody tells you that your only option is cystectomy, you should go get a second opinion from another urologist, because clearly we know very well, if we've learned nothing else in this podcast, there are plenty of options beyond cystectomy for patients. And I think that it's definitely behooves them to educate themselves, understand their options, and really figure out what's best for them and their family. Other thing I wanted, since you gave me the megaphone, I do want to put a plug in for our wonderful colleagues at BCAN. They have amazing patient resources. That's a great one-stop shop for somebody who's newly diagnosed with bladder cancer.
Awesome. And do you have their website handy? And where can people find out more information about Engene?
Yes, they, I believe is bcan.org, BCAN.org. I hope I got that right, Dr. Perlman. They can find out more information about us at engene.com. That's our corporate website, engene.com. And they can learn all about the Legend trial and detalimogene, our lead investigational product.
And you are right. It is bcan.org. I just looked.
Oh, perfect. Yes, that's right. Well, yeah, hopefully that'll be a resource for some folks out there. They really are a wonderful organization.
Awesome. Dr. Chan, always good to see you. Thank you so much for joining us today on Pearls and Perspectives.
Great to see you, Dr. Perlman. Thanks so much.